Sairam, dear listeners, this is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and it's 7:30 PM and this is the time we usually have the Radio Sai Answering Booth segment. But this week, I'm not going to be dealing with a question. A couple of times during the course of some of the questions that I answered, I made reference to a particular talk that I had given on the rituals and customs and how to understand them and when is it that they need to be reviewed, they need to be changed. I had given a talk on this particular topic a couple of years back. I think it could even be 3 years back. So today I'm going to play for you that talk. A lot of questions that I've dealt with, as I said, has references to some of the themes that I mentioned in this talk. So I hope that you will find this talk useful. I'll join you again next week with a question and next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth. In the meanwhile, if you have any questions on practical spirituality that you'd like me to answer on this show, you know what to do. You have to send me a mail at prem@radiosai.org. If you could record your question and send it along, that would be perfect. If you have any questions based on what I mentioned in this talk, feel free to send me that too. Over now to the talk that I had given a couple of years back in the Satsang Hall in Prashanthi Nilayam. I hope you find it useful. The title that I had given for the talk the time was Rituals and Customs, To Be or Not to Be. Happy listening. Sairam, I offer my most humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. I always consider it an onerous task to come and address you here because I see this as a gathering of seekers, people who are sincere about coming here, and to give a talk here itself is a very responsible action. And nevertheless, as I always begin, it might be me sitting here, it might be anybody here, but the one who speaks is only Swami. The one who listens is only Swami. So as always, I begin with that prayer that he makes us all understand that he is the one who listens and he is the one who speaks. Since it's a new beginning, maybe it wouldn't be out of place to start with something relating to Ganesha. We all have seen how Ganesh Chaturthi is celebrated in Prashanthi Nilayam, the fanfare and the chariot and palanquin procession which accompanies it, the lord of color and gaiety which goes with it. But in the earlier years, before the university came to be, when the Sri Satyasai Arts and Science College alone was there in Vrindavan, the practice of Ganesh Chaturthi was slightly different. They wouldn't make chariots and palanquins those days. They used to make Ganesha itself. It was Swami's instruction that a Ganesha be made out of clay and it be worshipped and then it be offered to a water body in a tank or a well. But the students used to make these Ganeshas, being not experts in making idols. Invariably, within those 3 days of worship, the idol used to crack or break away. And the warden noted that during those times, a lot of people used to fall sick in the hostel. A number of students used to fall ill. And tradition has it that you should not offer worship to an idol which is cracked, an idol which is having some kind of a fault in it. So the warden thought that maybe it is because of this act of worshipping an idol which is having a crack. So he suggested to the students that maybe this year, instead of making a Ganesha idol, why don't we procure a Ganesha idol, buy a Ganesha idol, and then offer worship to it? Because, you know, these events are happening. So that was the call of the warden. The boys agreed. But about a week before the festivals, suddenly Swami sent word for the warden. Swami asked him to come to Prashanthi Nilayam. On some other errand, Swami wanted to discuss something with him. Swami called him for an interview. And whatever had to be discussed was done with. And then Swami asked, how are the boys? What is happening in the hostel? And the warden suddenly remembered this Ganesh Chaturthi which was coming. And he told Swami, that Swami, we have made a decision. We've taken a decision that we will buy a Ganesh statue this time because of these reasons. And Swami straight away said, no. You should not. You should make a Ganesh statue. And then Swami went on to say, because there is a spiritual significance in it. You are trying to remind yourself that which has come from dust will go back to dust, even be it an idol of God. So this is a very important spiritual message in this custom which we follow. And so boys should make a Ganesha idol and worship it. So the decision was made. So the warden came back to Vrindavan and informed the boys. So this is what we are going to do. Swami has given us the instruction. So the boys were very happy. And so they started a couple of days before the festival. So how they would start is first to make a platform, put a few stones together, make a platform, and then chanting Ganesh Gayatri and Ganesh Atharvashirsham, they would put the first lot of clay on it and give aarti, and then begin the making of the Ganesh statue. When they put that first spoon or first spade of clay onto that platform, from nowhere a mouse came and went right under the platform. So they're wondering what to do now. Because you've started the worship, you cannot remove the platform, you cannot move it. So then they said, okay, the mouse went in, it'll come out. Because once it realizes there's nothing under there, it'll come out on its own. So they continued with the making of the statue. The clay idol was made, the worship was done. On the last day when they would lift this idol for the Visarjan function, when they lifted it, the mouse ran out. So then they realized, oh, this mouse has been there for 3 days. They said they were very happy, it was a sign of benediction. They thought it was a nice coincidence, something nice, memory to carry on. A couple of weeks passed, a month maybe, and Swami came to Vrindavan. And Swami is coming out of the car, just landing in Vrindavan, and Swami is asking, how did the Ganesh Chaturthi festival go? So the warden says, yes Swami, it went on well, we made the statue, we offered the worship. Swami says, I sent one mouse, did it come? This was a Swami, because he was the one who was encouraging us to do rituals, customs, sticking on to some of these practices. And what better and more beautiful way than to encourage it like this. And this was typically Swami, because Swami was always very particular about rituals and customs and following practices. The best example of that is the Dashara Yajnam and the other Yajnams which Swami performed. You would have seen that even the lighting of that fire is done in the most traditional way, by rubbing two pieces of wood together. In the 1960s, when Swami went to Badrinath, there was this one particular place called Brahma Kapal. It still is there. To offer worship to Pitrus, that is your ancestors who have moved on, that place is very sacred for that. And when Swami stopped at that place, Swami made the entire group do Pitru Puja there. It was a ritual which is passed on, and Swami was encouraging people to do that. I remember when I first joined, we were a little surprised by Swami's adherence to Rahu Kalam, Ashtami, Navami. We are in the presence of divinity. We are in the presence of the avatar. But we would see on Mondays, Swami would promptly come before 7:30 for darshan. Why? 7:30 to 9 Rahu Kalam. Swami is calling somebody for an interview. A very auspicious interview, let's say somebody's naming ceremony or somebody's marriage, Swami would call after Rahu Kalam. Swami is sending a student for PhD, Swami is sending somebody for any important task, Swami would say, wait till Uttarayanam. So Swami was very strictly adhering to all these customs, traditions, rituals. So definitely there is a reason why we follow rituals. There's a reason why we follow customs. There's a reason why we have been carrying on these things. Why do we do rituals? Why do we have rites? When I thought over it, I just came across, I could think of 5 reasons why we do that, and that's the order in which I'm going to put it for you. There could be many more, and there could be more profound ones, but these are in my humble opinion. One is for a sense of orderliness. When a group of individuals come together, when a society is formed, when a group is constituted, there is a certain amount of orderliness which comes when you document methodologies. When you say that this is how we will do the worship, this is how we will do this particular event. So there is a sense of orderliness which comes. A tribal community comes together, we say these are the kind of things which we'll do when a person gets married. These are the things which we'll do when a child is born. It is for a sense of orderliness. You know, that is the beauty. The word dharma, which means righteousness, the meaning of the word dharma is actually that which is placed to bring order. A group of individuals accept that by following this, there will be order in this group. That is dharma. That is ritual. Where we say we come together and we say we will do this for a sense of orderliness. And the other is a sense of belonging. You know, why are we all wearing whites here? And why are we all dressing in a certain method? Because it also, apart from the many things, it gives us a sense of belonging. It gives us a sense that we belong to this particular entity or this particular organization. For us, it is Swami. We all are clean shaven. And many times people ask, Shirdi Baba had a beard. So what is so sacrosanct about having a clean shaven face? Because it gives us a sense of belonging. It is not that I choose to have a mustache or not, or to have a beard or not. Because Swami likes it, we do it. It gives us a sense of belonging to this group. Just because we are clean shaven, we cannot claim to be more spiritual than Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, who had a beard. But it is wrong to associate spirituality with some of these things, which we accept on ourselves to bring a sense of orderliness and to bring a sense of belonging. The second one reason which I can think of is, when something has to be passed on, you cannot explain the reason why you're doing this, you just put it in a ritual. You know, what is a little complicated thing, you just want to pass it on, so you put it in a ritual. You cannot go around explaining it to a child every time. You cannot explain it to every common man. A simple instance is like, in South India we have this tradition, when you go to a temple, when you stand in front of the deity, you slap your cheeks. They do that. What a weird practice it is. You tap your cheeks. You know, a person is sleeping. If you want to wake up that person, they say the best way to wake him up is pat his cheeks. Because there are some nerves which go straight to the brain, that part of the brain which helps you wake up. So when you tap your cheeks, you wake up. You know, you're conscious to where you are. That is the idea of tapping your cheeks. And it very often happens when you go in front of a temple, when you go in front of the deity. We are physically in the presence, but our mind is in our world. The mind is in our daily tasks. The mind is thinking about what am I supposed to do when I leave the temple. I'm supposed to meet this person. I'm supposed to do these things. So it is said that when you tap, you are bringing yourself to that place where you are. No, I'm in front of the God now. I have to think of God, I have to think of divine things. It's a means of waking yourself to the present. This cannot be explained to every person who wants, you know. So what they say, go in front of the temple, you tap your cheeks. So it's a rite. It's passed on as a ritual. Another beautiful thing which we do is, when aarti is offered, we put out our palms and we take, you know, the blessings. It has been clinically proved that our palms have the best ability to extract energy, to absorb energy, and to emanate energy. From our body, the best part to emanate and absorb energy of any form is the palm. So say when they offer that worship and they give that Deeparadhana and they show it to the people, we all show our palms. Because that's the best way to absorb that energy. When a divine persona blesses, he shows his palms. Because that's the best way to pass on energy. This cannot be explained to everybody who comes by. And then they will ask, why not? Why only the palm? Maybe there are not explanations for this. This is an understanding which is passed on. So they say, this is how you do it. So it's passed on in a ritual. A very meaningful act is packaged in a ritual and is given to you. Follow it. One day you can find out why it is for, but as of now, just follow it. So that is the role of rituals. A thing which is very difficult to understand is put in a simple ritual. The other thing is also a simplification of a complex understanding. A very complex theme or a topic, you want to explain it to somebody. So you do it through an action. You know, when we were in school, when we were first taught addition, you have to count 4 plus 5. You know, they would have this interesting way of saying 4 in the mind, 5 in the hand, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I mean, do you need to do this to understand addition? Do you need to do this to be able to add? No, you don't. But in that child who doesn't know what is addition, who doesn't know what is mathematics, you are giving him a simplistic way of coming to that understanding. You're told, 5 in the mind, 4 in the hand. And in fact, very interestingly, many people actually carry it on till their youth. Suddenly one day you'll realize, oh, I'm still doing the same way of counting. The 3 in the hand, 4 in the mind. And you'll do it so fast that you don't realize that you're doing it. It is passed on. A very complex understanding is passed on as a simple, you know, as a representation in an action. In chemistry, we have this very interesting way of studying reactions through equations. Like suppose you ask me, what is this? It's water. In chemistry, we say H2O. You know, we represent it as H2O. If you were to take a molecule of water, look at it through the best of microscopes, you will not find even one molecule which looks like an H, which looks like a 2, which looks like a O. Then why this H2O? You take any other chemical, we say NaCl, we say H2SO4. No molecule in that substance is going to look like any of your H2, A, B, C, nothing. But we represent. We represent something which cannot be represented by something which is representable. We say, I represent this with alphabets. I represent this by this symbol. Why? Because now I can understand the behavior of this water. If you ask me what happens when water freezes, I can understand based on this representation which I'm giving, which is a false representation. But I'm conscious that it's a false representation. So sometimes rituals are passed on like that. There's a complex understanding which is passed on through a physical action. There are some other things, some rituals, which are very interesting, which are passed on as a pleasant memory. An event has happened in the past. You want to relive that moment. So you pass it on as a ritual. In fact, without our knowledge, we do that many, many times. We all are aware of the story of Bhadrachalam Ramdas, of how he builds the temple and he gets imprisoned for that. The Tanisha is finally made to understand that it was Lord Rama who came and gave him the money. So the Tanisha starts a tradition. Every year from his treasury, a gift goes to the temple of Lord Rama. He says, I remember this event happened and I'm so grateful that Rama came and opened my eyes. So I'm sending this as a mark of respect. Interestingly, till today, that tradition holds good. The state government sends that treasure now. State government sends that respect. Why? To remind yourself that one beautiful thing happened like this. There was one devotee to whose rescue the Lord came. It is to remind ourselves of a beautiful event. That ritual is for that. Will that ritual by itself give anything? No. It's a reminder. It reminds us of a pleasant happening. You know, when we were students in Vrindavan, there used to be a very clear thing which used to happen. We all sing aarti here. And after the aarti is over, we have this Narayan Narayan happening. There are 3 cycles of that Narayan Narayan happening, right? We all know that. But in Vrindavan alone, we used to have only 2 cycles. Even in the Sai Rameshwar. We used to sing only the first speed, second speed. Third speed would not be there. And I was wondering, what is this? Why a different tradition in Bangalore? Why a different tradition in Puttaparthi? So I asked one of my teachers, why do we have 2 Narayan Narayans in Vrindavan? He said, in the earlier years, the bhajans done by boys used to be separate. They used to have it in their hostel. In the hostel shed, they used to have the bhajans. And Swami would come and attend the bhajans. And that time, Swami would say, devotees are waiting. I have to go fast. Enough, stop with 2 Narayan Narayan. Swami said, enough, enough. 2 Narayana is enough. Stop with 2 speeds. And Swami would rush out for darshan. In memory of that beautiful, those beautiful moments, that 2 Narayan Narayan continued till 2000. Maybe till recently, and I think Swami would have changed it finally. But once I heard this event, every time we used to sing only 2 Narayan Narayans, I used to think how beautiful Swami used to come and attend bhajans in the hostel. Special session only for students and then go for devotees. It's for a pleasant memory. And the other point, the 5th point which I want to make, why we follow rituals, is quite similar to the earlier point which I made where I said, you know, something is very complex, you put it in a simple form. Some things just cannot be expressed at all. you've come to an understanding, you have found an understanding, how do I pass it on? No, people are not able to understand. So you put it in a ritual. You think of a ritual. A couple of months back, maybe more than a couple of months back, we met a very interesting person who came from South Africa. We interviewed him in Radio Sai. Father Francis, his name was. He was a South African Anglican priest who became very spiritual, and he felt that he needs to take on a spiritual quest. So he left his church for the time being. He came to India. He went to the Vaishnavi ashrams. Finally, right now he settled in the Ramanashram. He visited even Puttaparthi. And he started taking a liking in Vedanta philosophy, in the Hindu Vedanta. And he found that this is actually what Jesus is saying. This is actually what the gospel is saying. It is no different. He doesn't have to leave that to embrace this. So when he gets this new understanding that yes, Jesus also said the same thing, that all are one, that all are God. So now this understanding has come. Now he went back to his church. Now he was wondering, how do I pass on this information? How do I pass on this information that the Arunachala, who is worshipped as a pillar of fire, the same pillar of fire which appeared to Moses and guided him to Egypt? Because the Old Testament talks of the pillar of fire which comes and saves the people. And even Arunachala is supposed to be the pillar of fire. So he says this is the same thing. Now how do I pass on this information to the people? So he said, a ritual. So he started a ritual. He said there is one particular festival in the church called the Palms Day, where it is believed that Jesus, during his visits, was once worshipped with a lot of palm leaves. And that is followed in churches even till today, where they take a palm leaf, a kind of something made out of palm leaves, and they go around the church with a candle in their hand. So he said, let us take this candle and go to the Shiva temple nearby. And the priest of the Shiva temple would invite him into the Sanctum Sanctorum. He would place this candle in the Sanctum Sanctorum, and that priest would give a lamp from the temple which they would take and keep it in the church. He said he put it in the form of this ritual because he said, I have understood that everything is the same. I have come to the understanding that Shiva and Jesus are not different. But how do I pass on the information? He said, we'll put it in a ritual. We have this beautiful ritual of offering camphor, the arati. It's such a profound action which we do. Because in the earlier days, the main, what do you call, the garbhagraha, the innermost sanctum sanctorum of a temple, would be very, very dimly lit. There would be hardly one or two lamps, and it would be very difficult to see the statue completely. But when the worship would be completed, they would take the aarti and they would take it around the idol. They would show the head, they would show the right hand, they would show the feet, they would show the left hand, they would show the abdomen, and they would show the whole statue. That is the only time when you can see the whole statue. He told us that, what a beautiful ritual this is. Because you are trying to tell that God has covered himself with darkness. That is his maya. That you cannot see him. How do you see him? By upasana, by worship. When you worship him, the culmination of worship is aarti. The culmination of worship will reveal the God to you in parts. That is the significance of this aarti. So he said, I went back and started doing aarti for Jesus, the statue of Jesus. Because this was a beautiful concept which was encased in a simple ritual. And rituals are easy to pass on. There's another reason why rituals are done. It's a very subtle reason. I've spoken about this before, but I think it's not out of place to mention it here. Some rituals instill in us very subtle feelings. Like the experiment of Pavlov. Pavlov was a scientist whose dog taught him a very interesting learning. Dog taught him a very beautiful lesson. No, he had this dog. Whenever he would go home, he would take a biscuit or a, you know, something the dog likes and offer it to the dog. So the moment the dog sees this food in this guy's hand, it would start salivating. You know, that's the biological process. The enzymes in the saliva starts getting secreted. So the dog starts salivating. So then he realizes with time, the dog starts salivating the moment it sees him. It did not see the food. It sees Pavlo, it starts salivating. And then with time, the moment Pavlo enters the room, he starts salivating. So then he says that this is interesting. You know, you can understand if the dog salivates, if it sees food, but it is able to understand that when I come, I will offer it food and it starts salivating. And it's an instantaneous process. The dog is not telling anything to it itself. So he did a small experiment. Now he got the dog, he would keep food in front of it. The dog will start salivating. Then he started doing one thing. Every time he would place food in front of the dog, he would ring a bell. He did this for a lot of days. Then after a few days, he brought the dog, he only rang the bell, it started salivating. So it started without its knowledge associating the sound of this bell to food. Many times rituals are placed in our lives for that. Why do we ring the bell in a church? Why do we hear the gong? Because the moment we hear the gong, we think of Jesus. Why do we light agarbatti in front of our altar? Because that fragrance brings in us the ambience of a spiritual gathering, of a devotional moment. Why do we all dress modestly when we come to an ashram? Because when we are in a gathering of people who are dressed for a spiritual gathering, our thoughts get streamlined in that direction. Yes, of course, you can think of God sitting in a casino, but you need training for that. But to think of God sitting in the Kulwant Hall is very easy. To think of God when you're in a church, when you're in a mosque, when you're in a synagogue is very easy. Because there is that ambience for that. And many times rituals are meant for that. It gives you the ambience. It gives you what it requires to streamline your thoughts towards what you want to do. So from all that I've said, is it that the rituals and rites are all important? Is it that we should stick to them like we stick to our lives? When the first Dashara Yajna was held in Swami's presence, he drew to Swami one phenomenal personality. A person who had dedicated himself to the Vedas, Pandit Kamavadani. You know, he lived till he was more than 100 years. He first came when Swami performed the Dashara Yajna, but the moment he realized who Swami was, he stayed on ever till his last moments. A brilliant devotee. You would never see him without chanting Vedas. He would always be chanting Vedas. He is the teacher to all our senior most teachers who chant Veda in the Mandir, Vednarayan sir, and the people who are chanting with him. They all have learned from him. And they would say at the age of 9500, he would not let anybody clean his room. He would sweep it himself, mop it himself. A very, very strict disciplinarian, very orthodox, but who had realized what Swami was. So in those early years of association, one day Swami took him to Kodaikanal. So he was a very strict Brahmin, and he had this tradition that he could not eat food cooked by a non-Brahmin. And even the Brahmin who cooks needs to follow certain things. So that kind of removed cooked food from his menu. He cannot have cooked food at all now. So he went to Kodaikanal. A devotee was hosting him. The devotee had got along with him, a cook. Definitely a cook which did not fit the description Kamavadani had. So he went up to the host and told him that, see, I have all these things. I cannot eat any food which is offered to me. So can you please arrange for some milk and fruits? You know, that I can have. So I'll manage with that. So the host was ready to oblige. He said, definitely, sir, I understand that you will be following all these things. I will arrange for food, milk and fruits. So one day passed, 2 days passed. On the third day, Swami suddenly looked at Kamavadani and said,
Kamaldani, I don't see you at the dining table. Why are you not joining us for food?
So Kamaldani said, Swami, you know that I cannot eat this kind of food. You know, I have certain things which I follow.
Oh, what is it? Swami said.
So he said, Swami, I cannot eat cooked which is not cooked by Brahmins.
Then Swami asked him, Kamaldani, why did you come with me?
So Kamaldani was surprised. But he gave a straightforward answer. He said, Swami, because I think you are God. Because I believe that you are God.
Then Swami asked a very straightforward question. If you think I am God, the food which is holy and pure enough to be offered to me, is it not holy enough to be offered to you?
You know, the host came and tried to intervene. Swami, why do we make a big fuss out of this? I have no problem arranging for milk and fruits. No, let's not make an issue out of this.
Swami looked at him and said, you stay out of this.
Swami looked at Kamaldani and said, tell me, is this food not pure enough for you?
And Swami said, if it is not, then you don't have to be here.
And Swami looked at the host and said, pack his bags, send him back. So this host was running back and forth, Kamaldani, and he was telling, sir, we'll take care of it. Going to Swami, Swami, we'll handle it. Let's not make a big issue of it. Then finally, this was the final word. Swami said, pack his bags, let him go back.
And this person went to Kamaldani and said, sir, you please retire to your room. I will speak to Swami. You know, don't take any hasty decision.
Kamaldani is also as stern as Swami. No smile on his face. He's also sitting stoically. He looks at the host and says, keep a plate for me. I will eat the food.
And then the food was served, and the next thing he tells Swami, Swami, you could have done this drama 2 days back. I missed this good food for 2 days.
But here was a man for 80 years who had strictly followed the rites and rituals, the Vedas which he so dearly held. He followed that so strictly, and in one moment Swami made him break it. Because Swami made him understand, what are you doing all this for? If you are doing it for me, I am telling you to break it. But the beauty of Swami is, once he puts the ritual and the importance you give it to in the right place, then he will let you follow it. He said, now you can follow it, but never for a moment forget the place. Because many years later, in the 1970s, Mrs. Geeta Mohan Ram narrates this wonderful incident. You know, where Swami is there in a particular conference. The governor is supposed to attend there. One of the devotees who is with Swami is Mr. Kamaldani, the revered old person. You know, the governor gets late. The lunch gets delayed. And then Swami tells the organizers, you see, this Kamaldani is here. He does not eat the food which is served here. Because he was planning that once the session gets over, maybe it will get over at 2 o'clock or something. Then they can go back to wherever they were staying in Bangalore. And Kamaldani can have his bath, chant 108 Gayatris when he's having bath. Take 2 hours, 3 hours, do his puja and then have his food. It might be a bit late for him, but nevertheless he can follow his rites. So when this change of schedule happened, Swami said, hey, something needs to be done. Poor man, he'll have to go without lunch then. So Swami called Dr. Padmanabhan, Geeta Mohan Ram's father, and told him, we will go to your house, let him have food there. Because he was a Brahmin and, you know, he wouldn't mind having in their house. So they take a car, Swami, Dr. Padmanabhan and one more dignitary and Kamaldani, and they go to Geeta Mohan Ram's house. And when they go there, Mrs. Padmanabhan has gone to the conference. She's not there. So who's going to cook? Only the two young daughters there. One is 14 and the other is 13. So Swami comes and says, what is there for food? So the children say that, Swami, there's nothing here because only two of us. Your mother has just made some little bit of curry and we are supposed to manage with that. And Swami looks at the food and says, this is too little for him. So Swami says, okay, do something, you know, make it more, put a lot of rice, keep some curds, keep some rasam, and Swami instructs them. And these two little girls who have never cooked, they start cooking. And in the meanwhile, Swami tells that Kamaldani has to go and have a bath, otherwise you won't have food. So Swami takes him to the bathroom, you know, puts him in the bathroom. And these two girls are cooking there. Then Swami suddenly comes out and he finishes his bath, comes out and he says, where are my clothes?
I need to wear a fresh pair of clothes. Now Kamavdhani's luggage is in the other car, in Swami's car. And Swami has come in Dr. Padmanabhan's car. So crisis again. So then these two little girls come to Swami and say, Swami is asking for a fresh pair of clothes, we don't have any. And then Swami says, oh, his luggage is in the other car. Then Swami comes and says, open your mother's, you know, almira. Under the fourth sari, there is one pair of silk dhoti and angavastram. Get it and give it to him. And they go and check there, and there is, you know, needless to say, exactly a dhoti and angavastram there. And Swami says, your mother has kept it to give it to some poor Brahmin. No problem, you can take it and give it to this Brahmin. And it is given to him, and he comes and he sits. Now another crisis. Who will serve food for Kamavdhani? Because unmarried young girls cannot serve for him. It should either be a Brahmin male or a Sumangali. Then Swami says, see, you cannot serve food for him. So you both stand in the kitchen, pass the food to me, I will serve to him. He will not mind me serving because I am God anyway. You know? He knows that. So imagine that Swami which broke that ritual and his adherence to ritual so many years back was going out of his way to make sure that the same ritual which he was holding to was being fostered. Yes, we have to follow rituals, but it is very essential to remind ourselves what is the purpose behind that. Tell ourselves, why are we doing this, and is adhering to this ritual in any way taking us away from the purpose? Then there is no point. In the Ramakatha Rasavahini, Swami has a very beautiful account. I have not read it in any Ramayana, not that I have read many, but it's a very unique account there. When Rama, Sita and Lakshmana are banished to the forest, they're going in search of a place where they can spend 14 years. They go to the ashram of sage Bharadwaja. So they spend one night there. The idea is to ask him where to camp. So it is sage Bharadwaja who says that you can go to Panchavati. It's a nice place, you can stay there. So they camp overnight in the ashram of Saint Bharadwaja. The next morning, Rama and Lakshmana wake up early. They go to the sage and they tell him, come, let us go to the river for our morning ablutions. Let us go, we have to do the morning sandhya and all the rituals which go with it. So they go and invite the sage. The sage looks at them and says, what for? And Rama is surprised, at least apparently. He's saying that, don't you do these things every day? The sage says, yes, we did. Then why are you not coming with us today? Then Saint Bharadwaja says, Rama, all these years I did all these rites, all these years I did all these rituals for this moment of seeing you face to face. Do you think I'll be stupid enough to continue this even after receiving what I did all this for? He said, you have come for a drama, you can continue your drama. But I have no reason to continue this. So does that give us the license to give up all these rituals? I don't think so. For the simple reason that sage Bharadwaja, when he saw Lord Rama, he felt it was the end of the culmination of all his wishes. But for us, it's the other way around. Coming to meet Swami and coming face to face Swami is the beginning of all our wishes. So that is why we are not ready to say that I have come and I have received all that I have to receive, I can stop. If any of us here feel that way, maybe we are absolutely right in stopping everything. I don't think anybody can point a finger at us. But the most important thing when we follow rituals, when we do all these things, is to every now and then look at these rituals, look at these customs, look at these practices which have come down, and understand what is the context in which it was given. What is the context and what is the idea behind it? And are we carrying forward the idea? What Swami would often say very jovially is about the Satyanarayana Puja. You know, there is one couple who is doing Satyanarayana Puja and there is this mischievous cat in the house. So every time they do the Satyanarayana Puja, this cat comes and jumps into all the offerings and defiles everything. So then the practice comes that every time they're doing Satyanarayana Puja, first thing is catch the cat and put it under the basket. And then do the Satyanarayana Puja. So years pass, the cat dies, the son takes on the tradition. Now the son says, how can I do Satyanarayana Puja without the cat? So he goes and procures the cat, catches it, puts it under the basket, and then does the Satyanarayana Puja. Swami says, this is what happens when you don't understand why a certain practice was set. You know, we have this beautiful practice, you know, a very debated topic about Indianism, Hinduism, the Bharatiya culture, is the Varna system. You know, this class system, Brahmin, Kshatriya, Shudra, Vaishya. If we understand why it was laid, we can abandon the system and modify it for the current day. Let me just take a simple example. You know, there are four classes. Economically speaking, the highest is the Kshatriya. The next is the Vaishya. Then comes the Brahmin and the Shudra. Spiritually speaking, the Brahmin is the highermost class. Now, there is a tradition, they say, when you're doing a good act, let us say you're doing a puja, you're doing a marriage, you're performing a yajna, you have to give charity to a Brahmin. Now, this is interesting because economically speaking, the lowest is the Shudra. So, if you actually have to do charity, you should do charity to a Shudra. Why are you doing charity to a Brahmin? But what are we doing today? No, you have to do charity only to a Brahmin. The Brahmin might be working in an MNC, but we will go and feed him. What is the idea behind this doing something for a Brahmin? And how can we replicate it in our present day? I may not be entirely right, but this is my understanding. You know, a Shudra is a man who earns every day. He's a laborer. When he does a work on a particular day, he gets paid for that day. So his work is proportional to the salary which he gets. And in those days it was barter system. You know, you would get food in return for work. To such a person, if you give food free, to such a person if you give money free, he will proportionally reduce the work which he does. He will tell that, okay, you have given me money which can take me 3 days, so I don't have to work 3 days. But the Brahmin is not like that. The Brahmin is not supposed to do any work for money. He is supposed to do work for the work's sake. So to such a Brahmin, if you give money or food, he will do more work. The good work which he is doing, he will do more of it. So that is the idea when they say you have to do charity to a Brahmin. So how do we understand that in the present day? You have NGOs, non-government organizations. You have charitable trusts. You know, when you give money to them, they will not reduce their activity. They will do more of their activity. Because you are not removing the strain from them, but you're giving them an opportunity, a more freedom to work more. So the charity which you do should enable that person to do more. It should not make that person lazy. But the spirit is forgotten. We stick to, you have to do charity to a Brahmin. You have to feed a Brahmin. Your puja is not complete if you have not fed a Brahmin. You can still feed a Brahmin, but if that Brahmin fits this description, if he is not doing work for the money, if he is not doing work for the resources, this kind of an active system, where we look at our activities, we look at our rituals, is the spirit being carried forward. And any culture which is able to look at its own traditions and say, are we able to modify it for the current time? That culture will live longer with the spirit of the culture. Once somebody asked Mahatma Gandhi, they said, you talk about non-violence, you always stand by non-violence, and then you say, I draw all my inspiration from the Bhagavad Gita. You know, in the Bhagavad Gita, 18 chapters, Krishna gives him all the wisdom to Arjuna and says, now go and fight, now go and kill. You are saying that you draw inspiration from the Bhagavad Gita and you're propagating non-violence? Isn't there a mismatch? And then Mahatma Gandhi says a beautiful thing. He says, I do not draw my inspiration from the Bhagavad Gita. I take the Bhagavad Gita inside and I draw inspiration from inside. The Bhagavad Gita taken in and the inspiration comes from within. every ritual, every practice, every action, if it's understood, and we say, what is it meant to be now? How do we take this forward now? And then I feel it will give the true understanding. And that is what Swami did. You know, if you look at it, I was telling you why Brahmins were specially given that status in the olden days, in the early years. And if you see, what were the portfolios that the Brahmins handled in the olden kingdoms? There were two. One was medicine, the other was education. All the Ayurveda was saved by the Brahmins, the sages, and education. The Gurukulas were always held by the Brahmins. So you cannot have that system now. You cannot have only Brahmins being doctors, you cannot have only Brahmins being lecturers and professors. But Swami brought the spirit. What was the spirit? Swami said education and medicine should be free. Education and medicine should not have a price tag on it. That was the essence of the practice of Brahmins handling those two portfolios in those years. Swami brought that essence. Swami started free hospitals, free education. But Swami does not encourage giving everything free. Swami does not say give free food all the time. Swami did not encourage that. Because that which makes a person lazy is not charity. But certain things have to be given free. Swami said education and medicine must be free. But who gets to God fastest? No, that's what we want to know. Which is the shortest route? Should we follow rituals? Or should we follow our heart and say throw all the rituals away. Let's just get to God. Because after all, God is beyond all this. Now, that's what we always want to know. Tell me which is the shortest. Okay, rituals are good. Okay, rituals are bad. But which is the shortest? But that's the beauty. You know, the history shows us that both have achieved it. One of the grandest stories in that is that of the Periya Puranam, where you have the story of Kannappa Nayanar. You know, the Lord, the devotee who gives his eyes to Shiva. There is this tribal chieftain. His name is... He was called Kannappa later. I don't know what he was called before. For some reason, he gets a very, very strong attraction to this lingam in the temple in Kalahasti. Now, he sees the lingam. The first time he sees it, he's so drawn to it. And the author of Periya Puranam, Sundara Nayanar, says that it can only be because of the past. That the moment he sees it, he feels a connect with the Lord. But he is a tribal chieftain. He doesn't know what to do. So what does he do? Every day, in a leaf which is converted into a plate, he brings the meat which he eats. The fresh, sweet meat. He chooses the best meat. He puts it in that. And he has to take water. He has to climb a hill and go to the temple. So what does he do? He takes water in his mouth. And he goes to the temple, keeps the meat in front of the Lord, and spits the water, saying, "This is water for you." You know, what a horrible practice. And the priest of that temple, who is a very, very ritualistic man, and who is also very, very devoted, every day when he comes for the worship, he sees that meat is lying there, and somebody spit on this lingam, and all kinds of defiling things around. So every day he sheds tears. He said, "Who is doing this to you, O Lord? Who is doing this?" So he cleans the whole thing, and he does the whole purification ritual every day. And he's so pained. He said, "Lord, who's doing this to you? Who's doing this to you?" So here is one ritualistic devotee, and the other is a devotee who doesn't know to worship the God through rituals. So one day when he's standing and crying in front of the lingam, you know, the Lord tells him, "Hide behind the bush and see the play." So that's what he decides to do that day. He goes and hides behind the bush, and that day, one of the eyes of that lingam, you know, they have that eyes drawn on the lingam, starts bleeding. And then he sees this chieftain coming with the same offering of water in the mouth and meat in his hand. He comes there and he's shocked to see this bleeding eye of this lingam. Then he says, "Oh Lord, what has happened to you?" So what does he do? He takes his arrow, pulls out one of his eyes and places it on the lingam. And this pujari who is standing there is shocked. Because his eyes are opening to what devotion does this man have. And then the moment he places that eye on the lingam, the other eye starts bleeding. This man says, what is this? Your other eye also is bleeding. So he is about to pull out the other eye when he realizes that if I pull out this eye, how do I know where to place it? No, he can pull it out, but now he is blind. How do we know where to place it? So what does he do? He puts his foot on the lingam where he is supposed to place the eye and then pulls out the eye and places it there. And this was it. You know, the ritualistic pandit who saw this, he said, what rituals am I talking about? This man has understood the essence of devotion. But why was he privileged to see that sight? Wasn't it because he had stuck to his path assiduously? Just as Kannapa Nayanar had won the Lord's grace through his innocence, didn't this pujari, this pandit who stuck to his rituals also win the grace? Because he got to see, that is what the author says, that blessed is that man who gave his eyes, blessed is this man who got to see that sight. So what can we choose between the two? If there is anything we need to choose, it is at any moment see what does Swami want out of us. You know, if there is any time a clash between a ritual and the person for whom we are doing the ritual, I think it's always the person who should win. And that is what Swami proved time and again. The same Swami who said Rahu Kalam is important, would sometimes test us by telling us to start things on Rahu Kalam. I remember when we had the children's festival in 2005, when we had all these Balvikas children coming, the festival of joy. Swami inaugurated the festival bang on Rahu Kalam. And in fact, he told it in the discourse, we have started this program in a very inauspicious time. At that time, are we going to go and remind Swami that, Swami, this is Rahu Kalam, can you start it now? So when there is a conflict between what is right, rituals, or to go beyond it, I think that time there should be no doubt. But it is all the more very important to see that, are we following these rituals in the right spirit? Are we going back? Neither debunking those rituals completely, not dismissing them completely, nor accepting them blindly. But in fact, when I say accepting them blindly, that also is important. There is one section of the society for that. Because otherwise these rituals will get dead somewhere on the way. If you have one generation of skeptics, the whole Indian culture will be gone. There needs to be some people who will blindly follow this. So it is also important not to judge them, not to look at them and say how stupid you all are. And that is Swami's balance. He would keep those people who will carry forward the tradition, and he will keep those people who will always rejuvenate the tradition, who will look at the tradition and say, what best way can we take it? There was one Mahatma Gandhi who came by. There was one Rajaram Mohan Roy who came by, who looked at traditions and said, when traditions start getting imposed on people, when traditions start conflicting what the current day trends suggest, then you need to rethink. You need to relook at them. And that is what is most important. You know, there is this two characters in Bhagavatam. Maybe I'll end with that. When Adi Shankara is traveling all around the place, he goes to one particular village of all Brahmins, all learned scholars. The description of the village is every house emanates the smell of Agnihotra. The yagnam is going on in every house, and that is how sacred the place is. And in that village, there is one Brahmin who has a stupid son. The son has been initiated, Upanayanam has been done, but he has no interest in Vedas. He has no interest in learning, and he is all the time looking blank. He is playing with sand, he is rolling in the dust. So the father brings this child, comes to Adi Shankara, and tells him, Master, I am so and so, I am a Brahmin, and in fact he was one of the most learned ones in that village, but this is my son. He's a simpleton. He's a stupid. He shows no interest in the Vedas. He shows no interest in learning. So Adi Shankara looks at this boy, who's maybe in his teens, and asks him, who are you? Where have you come from? Where are you going? And then the boy reels out in pure Sanskrit one of the greatest verses in Advaita. He says, I'm not a man, I'm not Yaksha, I'm not Brahmin, I'm not Shudra, I'm not Vaishya. I'm not this body, I'm not this mind. I am knowledge. And then Adishankara realizes, this is a boy who was grown out of all this. And he names him Hastamalaka. A very weird name. He says Hastamalaka. Hastamalaka means, Amala means the gooseberry. Hastamalaka means the gooseberry in the hand. Adishankara explains, wisdom to this boy is like gooseberry in his hand. It is so spontaneous and readily available for him. He is Hastamalaka. So there is always a very close connection between the dumbest and the most wisest. It is very difficult to judge. And the other beautiful character which the Bhagavatam talks about is the King Bharata. Now King Bharata is a very pious king. He has ruled his kingdom very well. But unfortunately, you know, he takes a vanaprastha when he is older. He gives the kingdom to his sons. He goes to the hermitage. He becomes a recluse. And then he saves a baby deer. That's what the story goes. He saves a baby deer. Unfortunately, the man who has given up everything gets attached to that deer. In the last moment when he's dying, he's thinking of his deer. And the next birth, he's born a deer. But he's born a deer with all the spiritual urges and the spiritual quest in him. So the deer goes to an ashram and lives in an ashram. So the deer's life is ending, and then he is born in a Brahmin family. But when he's born in a Brahmin family, he's born a stupid. This character is called Jada Bharata. You know, in Bhagavatam, he says the useless Bharata, you know, the inert Bharata, that's what it means. Because he has reached the state where he is beyond all these restrictions, beyond all these learnings, chanting mantras, chanting shlokas. He was another person who proved that it is very difficult to judge. So similarly, when we look at rituals, it's very difficult to say what is right, what is wrong, what is correct. So maybe it's the only thing left is to pray to Swami and make sure that never we give more importance to the means than the ends. Give importance to the means because it takes us to the ends, but never give more importance than the ends itself. Follow whatever you're following because it pleases Swami. You know, many times people would come and ask, why do you do Suprabhatam in the morning in the hostel? You know, why do you wear whites? Why do you wear this? Honestly, I have no answer for it because we never asked ourselves. Because for us, Swami likes it. Swami will be happy if we do this. You know, why do you do this? Is there a scientific reason? I don't know. And I don't have to know. It pleases Swami. It is something which you do. You know, Swami, I cannot express my devotion, but I'm going to do it in this way, hoping that you will accept this as an expression of my devotion. Once in a temple, a juggler who works in a circus, he goes to the temple, stands in front of the deity and starts juggling. You know, with his balls, he starts juggling. He's going on and on and on. The story goes, the deity in the temple gets curious. He says, what is this guy up to? What is he trying to do? So the deity appears in front of him and he says, look man, what are you trying to do? What are you juggling in front of me for? Why are you performing this stunt in front of me? Don't you know that I don't fall for stunts? That's what God tells him. Then the juggler says, oh Lord, I know you don't fall for stunts, but this stunt is all I have. This stunt is all I have to offer to you. So he says, dear Lord, take this stunt devotion of mine and give me true devotion. And many of the rituals which we do are like that. Swami, I don't know why I'm doing this. Swami, I don't know for what for I'm doing this. But I'm doing this for you. If you feel that it is not worth, then stop me from doing it. I'm ready to stop it. But if you can take this and give me true devotion, take this stunt devotion of mine and give me true devotion. Maybe it's the best way to end with this prayer which an American philosopher once framed. Unfortunately, I couldn't get to pronounce his name. I got to know his name only this morning, but couldn't get his name. But the prayer is very profound, and I think it's the best way to approach all these confusions in our life. He says, God, give me the grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed. Courage to change the things which should be changed. And the wisdom to distinguish one from the other. Making this prayer and offering to Swami and offering this talk at Swami's lotus feet. I thank you all for your patient listening. Jai Sai Ram.
Koyila kusina ragama.